Meeting the Lake by Hannah Pitta Aoki. The first time I read Non-Human Others and Kaupapa Māori Research by Te Kawaho Hoskins and Alison Jones, it was a green light moment. I remember furiously sticking post-it notes on so many of its passages. It articulated so much of the dissonance I had felt reading Rosie Braidotti, Bruno Latour, and even Donna J. Haraway. It wasn't necessarily that I disagreed with these philosophers, nor did I struggle to understand their sometimes frustratingly overcooked understanding of being in relation, or of the interconnections that exist between other forms of life and matter that are around us. It was that it felt familiar, yet I could not express why. And the more I read, the more I felt that language used by many of the post-human and ecological philosophies was inadequate at describing these complexities. I have returned to this text a number of times and have even studied the endnotes and footnotes, which have introduced me to new thinkers and has continued to feed my intellectual curiosity for years. It has deeply informed so much of the trajectory of my work as an artist and as a writer. It's rich and generous, and it feels important to acknowledge how indebted I am to these authors. Whenever I reread this text, I find myself particularly drawn to excerpts describing the Māori exchange of hou and the difficulty and impossibility of adequate translation of te reo Māori kupu into English. For instance, words in te reo Māori are not merely words, but are entire conceptions of how we, Māori, understand the world. A world like whakapapa cannot be understood as just genealogy, when it encompasses all life that exists and has ever existed and that will ever exist, and cannot be bound to Western ontologies of linear time. Translation is so important because we know from our history that certain words are not translated with care, such as when the missionary Henry Williams translated Te Tiriti o Waitangi into English overnight. We now know that there is a huge difference in meaning between kawanatanga and tino rangatiratanga. In this text, Hoskins and Jones interrogate both the Māori ontological understanding of Māori, mana, and wairua, and the agency of the non-human, alongside that of a land deed signed by the Ngāpuhi Rangatira Hongi Hika. As a child, I spent a lot of time on Hika's whenua, visiting my grandparents, who often took us for ice cream by the stone store. There is a ridge above the stone store that was Kororipo Pa, now a historic walking path. I once ran it with my younger cousins to help them train for their school cross country. In 1814, Hika travelled to Sydney with his nephew Ruatara and Thomas Kendall, a missionary and arms dealer who had befriended Hika. Once in Sydney, they met the missionary Samuel Marsden and invited him to move to their territory and establish the first Anglican mission in New Zealand. Hika, who belonged to the hapu Ngā Terehua, signed a land deed for 13,000 acres that later became Kirikiri by signing his mata ora in 1819. By signing his mata ora, he was not just signing his face, but the living face or the face of well-being marked on his body to connect him with his ancestors, both those who had passed and those yet to come. By making these marks on paper, a dead tree, also an ancestor, which is remade into paper, Hika inscribed the essence of his life force, the ihi, wihi, and wana of his being. Why on earth would he sign away this land from his people and thereby permanently alienate them from the land? No Māori rangatira would do this. It's completely untenable. Therefore, this cannot be regarded as a land deed in the European sense of the word, but rather as an exchange of breath, a hoe, a promise, a living testament to the complexities within the relationship forged between Māori and Pākehā in the 19th century. What, of course, complicates this narrative of bicultural harmony is what came next, which was not just both the signing of He Whakaputanga in 1835 and Te Tiriti o Waitangi in 1840, but the musket wars led predominantly by figures like Hika. When visiting Australia in 1814, Hika had studied European farming and had also started to grow much easier crops such as the potato and could therefore provide greater sustenance to his people. Hika had also made careful notes of European military techniques and purchased a number of muskets. It was the accumulation of these muskets that resulted in Hika being able to carry out a number of attacks on other iwi all around the country, including kidnapping some of my Ngāti Mahuta ancestors and massacring some of my Te Arawa whanaunga near Lake Rotuiti using Te Ara or Hene Hopu track, commonly referred to as Hongi's track. While rereading this text, I cannot help but think about the actions of Hika, whose exchanges made with Pākehā introduced technologies that vastly impacted upon so many other Māori communities. For better or worse, these actions changed the course of history across this land. As researchers and collaborators, Hoskins and Jones have a methodology for writing together that can be described as embodying the Māori Pākehā hyphen, which acts as a way of learning, understanding, and exchanging hou. It presents the best possible way forward for Māori and Pākehā, a way of meeting in the middle, wainanui. Both authors admit it's messy where they write as an endnote. This is a complicated assertion. Our individual identities are far more fluid than the simple dualism, settler, indigenous, suggests. Te Kawahau is a scholar in the Western Academy, for instance. Alison is a Pākehā who defines her cultural identity in relation to and with Māori. When you exchange hongi, you infuse your life force with another. In a deeper sense, it's an acknowledgement of the ways in which human beings are entangled with forces and beings that exist within the world that cannot be neatly categorized into a Cartesian split or be seen simply as hyphen. When Māori introduce themselves to one another, we describe ourselves as being a river, mountain, an entire tribe or ancestor. Ko au te awa, ko te awa ko au. I am the river and the river is me. When I speak to the rivers I belong to, I describe them as being a part of me in the literal sense. It is a way of understanding the world which has offered a creative approach to the interpretation of New Zealand law, which resulted in New Zealand passing a law granting legal personhood status to the Whanganui River in 2017. This law decrees that the river is a wholly living entity from the mountain to the sea. It incorporates both physical and metaphysical elements of the river. This particular legal approach has set an international precedent that has been followed by some other countries, including Bangladesh, which in 2019 granted all its rivers the same rights as people. This is perhaps an example of the ways in which Māori and Indigenous people around the world, especially in the so-called Global South, understand the rights and responsibilities they have to the non-human entities that exist around us. In the footnotes, an example Hoskins and Jones cite is that of the late Anishinaabe or Chupoi thinker Wabe Kanyu, where he wrote in his treatise, "We have the right to exist," a translation of Aboriginal Indigenous thought, the first book ever published from an Anishinaabe or Chipoy perspective, that a person meets the lake rather than goes to get water.
These beings and ideas of how to live with the non-human, whether it is a building,
a taonga, Pounamu, a tree, a river, or lichen cannot be understood as having simply thingness. It's much bigger than that, nor can it be understood as something that can be owned in the capitalist understanding of exchange. Sharing ho cannot equal the alienation of land forever in the form of a land deed, even if the stone store is built on top of it. We can only live in kinship with these forces and understand that they need to be cared for and respected as part of the whakapapa of all beings that exist, have existed, and will continue to exist long after we leave this world.